It's Memorial Day weekend of 2012. Miami Beach is packed with partiers in town for Urban Beach Weekend, one of the busiest events of the year. Among the partygoers is Miami local Rudy Eugene.
He went down to the beach. His car broke down at a gas station, so he started walking down the causeway.
And what Rudy Eugene did next captured the attention of the world.
Apparently, removing his clothes and swinging from the lamp poles, and then eventually attacking Mr. Popo.
The attack became one of the most inexplicable and horrific crimes ever to occur in Miami, leaving victim Ronald Popo in critical condition.
Fighting for your life, being overpowered, having your whole face demolished, that's horrible.
Hi, I'm Joey Dowd.
And I'm Kareem Tapsch.
Beaches, nightlife, and tropical weather may be what folks think of when they think Florida. But as Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
Each week we'll bring you a new episode of a true crime case committed right here under the Florida sun. From the outrageous to the utterly bizarre. Think you've heard it all? Think again. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami. It's Memorial Day weekend, May 26, 2012. 31-year-old Rudy Eugene drives to Miami Beach in his Haitian flag-draped purple Chevy Caprice. He's going to South Beach for Urban Beach Weekend, an annual hip-hop festival. Around noon, he tries to start his car, but it's dead. After waiting 30 to 40 minutes, he decides to walk back to Miami.
Now, Miami Beach is an island about 3 miles off the coast of Miami. It's connected to the mainland by a handful of bridges and causeways. One of the main ones is MacArthur Causeway, which connects South Beach to downtown Miami. Rudy starts the 3 mile walk across this causeway.
Along the way, according to eyewitnesses, he begins stripping off his clothing and tosses his license. By the time he reaches the end of the 3 mile causeway, he's completely naked.
When you finally reach Miami, the first thing you walk under is an overpass for the Metro Mover, a small rail system to get around downtown Miami. In the shade, underneath this overpass, was 65-year-old Ronald Popo.
Now, we have no idea what prompted what happened next, but Rudy began attacking Ronald. He stripped him of his pants, and then he bit his face.
And not just one bite. He tore off 75% of Ronald's face above his beard with his teeth, according to the BBC. Larry Vega, a passing bicyclist, saw what was happening and called 911. He said there was blood all over the place, and when he told Rudy to get off, he said, quote, "The guy just kept eating the other guy away, like ripping his skin," end quote.
A few minutes later, Miami police officer Jose Ramirez arrived at the scene. After processing what he was witnessing, he wanted Rudy to stop attacking Ronald. According to Larry Vega, the cyclist, Rudy just lifted his head up with a piece of flesh in his mouth and growled. And then he resumed biting Ronald. Officer Ramirez then shoots Rudy once. That doesn't stop him. He then shoots him another 4 times, killing Rudy Eugene.
The whole ordeal lasted less than 20 minutes. At the end, Ronald is hanging on to life but survives, and Rudy Eugene lays dead. As for the event itself, this story blew up around the world.
Those who witnessed it all describe it as a scene out of a zombie horror film.
A man eating away at the flesh of another man.
The man now known as the Causeway Cannibal.
Cannibal attacker, Rudy Eugene.
The now infamous cannibal attack.
Now, living in South Florida, we're rather used to unbelievable news coming from our hometown.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Florida Man Twitter account blew up in popularity thanks to crazy stories from the state. But the story was too crazy to believe. My mom was working at the Miami Beach Police Department, and she called me and was like, there was a zombie attack on MacArthur.
Yeah, I mean, I remember getting a ton of messages from friends around the country who were like, what the hell is going on down there? My partner's mom saw it on Taiwanese news and was worried about us living in Miami. But I gotta admit, I made a few crude jokes to myself about this, and I wasn't the only one. Lots of people were laughing it off as some sort of bizarre story. Too weird to be true. Including Marcus and Charles.
I remember I was in downtown at my homeboy crib, and we were talking about it, and it was just kind of like, we were like making jokes, like it was lighthearted, right? It was lighthearted, but we was like, yo, that's crazy. You know what I'm saying?
Except what Markinson didn't realize at the time was that the story would directly impact his life.
When I first heard about it, I didn't even know that was my brother.
It wouldn't be until the next day that Markinson found out that his older brother, Rudy Eugene, was the attacker and what had happened to his brother.
That morning, what happened was I was just sleeping. I was awakened by like the wailing of my mother. I jumped out of bed, ran to her room, like, yo, what's going on? And my mom's is there with her friend. And he says to me in Creole, he says, yo, tia wudi. And I understood that to say, tia wudi, which would mean remove Rudy. So I said, remove Rudy where? Where is Rudy? Remove him where? He said, no, yo, tia. That means they killed him. So I just fell on the floor and just started crying with my mom. And I lost it, man. I lost it, man. I had a motorcycle that time, man. I jumped on the highway and I just rode that thing, man. And I screamed and yelled while I just like rode on I-95. I was so angry. I was angry that they killed him.
People were looking for any kind of explanation for what would make someone eat another person's face. I mean, was it something supernatural? Was it a mental breakdown? Was it drugs?
Pretty quickly, there was one drug that became the primary focus.
Drugs known as bath salts being blamed for a gruesome scene in Miami.
Bath salts were a relatively new synthetic drug that showed up in the U.S. in 2010. There were already horrifying stories of what people did on bath salts.
A mother left her 2-year-old in the middle of a highway because she thought he had demons.
A 21-year-old shot himself 3 days after taking bath salts and having constant hallucinations of police cars and helicopters outside his house, ready to take him away.
Mark Ryan, director of the Louisiana Poison Center, described bath salts as, quote, take all the bad attributes of ecstasy, PCP, LSD, cocaine, methamphetamine, lump them together, and that's what you get with bath salts, end quote.
So bath salts fit the bill when looking for an explanation of what would drive one man to eat another man's face. And there was some circumstantial evidence to support this idea. When police tracked down Rudy's broken car in Miami Beach, they found 5 empty water bottles on the floor. Excessive thirst is a common side effect after taking synthetic drugs like ecstasy.
But we should also point out that by late May in Miami, the weather can often peak to the high 80s. For Markinson, the idea of Rudy taking drugs never made sense.
I always thought that was real bizarre, you know, because my brother, he don't do drugs. He smoke weed. He might drink a little beer, a little Hennessy or something if you bring out the bottle, you know what I mean? He might drink a little something, but he's not going to get drunk. So he smoke weed, and that's it. So I'm like, bad salt. I said, bro, somebody must have drugged him. I said, no, he went to South Beach by himself. Like, maybe somebody drugged him.
The only thing that could clear this up was the autopsy results. But as it turns out, this would only create more questions than answers. So we've got this horrific attack where Rudy Eugene bit off most of Ronald Popo's face.
And everyone is talking about bath salts, this new synthetic drug that can supposedly drive people to do crazy things. But all of this leaves a lot of unanswered questions.
Was Rudy on bath salts or some other type of drugs? What prompted him to attack Ronald?
Was he cursed? Was this an untreated mental illness episode?
A lot of these questions will never be answered because police shot and killed Rudy. But some might be, especially when the autopsy reports come back. Before we talk about the what-ifs, though, let's take a look at Rudy's life prior to May 2012.
Rudy was born in 1981 in Miami. His parents were Haitian immigrants who had divorced only a few months after he was born.
Growing up, you know, he was a nice person, a very nice person, but you would always, he liked to be his own boss. He liked to do his own businesses, you know, whether it was cutting grass or doing car washes, things like that. Oh, and man, the kid could draw. He could draw anything. He was really good at, like, drawing. He actually drew all of his tattoos that he had. He drew them all.
As a kid, Markinson told us that there were early signs of anger issues in Rudy.
You would always see, like, flashes of anger, you know.
Rather than send him to counseling or therapy, Rudy was encouraged to play football to curb his aggression.
You know, unfortunately, like, society and my family weren't really hip to, like, mental illness. You know what I mean? So no one really sought to, like, help an individual who was going, like, when he had anger issues, what they tried to do, that's why they put him in football, you know? A security guard encouraged him to play football so he could release some of his anger. And that's how he started playing football, because he was getting in trouble in school a lot because he was always fighting and stuff.
Rudy played football as a defensive end. According to Markinson, he was a pretty good player. He also loved the movie Rudy, the 1993 film starring Sean Astin as the underdog who works his way to play football for Notre Dame.
You know, he loved that movie, Rudy, because that was his name. That was his name, and it was a football movie, you know, so he always loved that movie, too.
Despite the attempts to curb his anger issues with football, Rudy was arrested 8 times, starting at age 16. At one point, he threatened to put a gun to his mother's head and kill her, according to a story from the Miami New Times. Markinson says they weren't close as kids, but as they got older, that changed.
Like, when we got into our, when I was about 18, I guess he was about, like, 21, 22, that's when we got a lot closer, like, when I moved away to college, and then I came back, and, you know, we just really started to develop a bond, because we were kind of like our own individuals by that point. Like, we were grown-ups, in a sense, you know? So I think that we meshed a lot better then.
As grown-ups, like, what was your relationship like as adults?
I mean, like, we wouldn't really go out too much, but we would always hang out, like, around the house. There were a few times where we would go out, you know, but we just hang out in the backyard, you know, just chilling, man, you know what I mean? Just chilling, having some drinks, you know, hanging out, playing video games.
Rudy was married at one point, but it was short-lived, and they were divorced after 3 years. He held various jobs, including selling CDs, working at McDonald's, working telemarketing, and washing cars, which was the last job he had before he died.
Despite his occasional anger issues and life challenges, one of the things Markinson laments was that the sensationalistic nature of the media coverage never shared Rudy's positive attributes.
I came from Tallahassee. I don't have a job yet or nothing like that, you know what I mean? And my brother, he just gave me $200, you feel me? Like, I didn't even ask him for it. He just like, yo, I know you're getting back down here. You're going to need a little money. You want to get around. You want to take out a little honey, like whatever, you feel me? You know? So, and like, he just blessed me like that, you know, like for no reason, because he's my big brother, you feel me? That's like a simple memory that like I'm very fond of, because it was just such a brotherly moment. He just did it off love, like, and that's the kind of things he would do, man.
Rudy was also the one that kept the family connected, especially with their extended network of cousins and aunts and uncles.
He was also like probably the one that like tried to keep in touch with like the family members, like. He would keep in touch with some cousins that I didn't even know were my cousins. You know what I'm saying? But he was like, yo, that's our cousins. And then I found out that was our cousin. But I didn't know. You know what I'm saying? Because he was older than me. So, you know, he knew more of the family than I did. But he was always, like, hanging out with different members of the family. You know, he stopped by people's house. You know, he'll wash their car for them. You know what I'm saying? Like, hey, that boy right there, man, he's something special, man. But they didn't want to explore that because, like I said, like they don't want to see the human side when they do these stories.
Another thing about Rudy is he held on to his Christian upbringing.
We grew up in a Christian house. You know, we all take our own path in life, but like he always held on to his Christianity. He would always read the Bible and he quote verses. He'd be like, yo, let's pray in the morning. You feel me? Like he the one that called me and said, yo, did you pray today? Yo, let's pray real quick. You feel me? Like, even though he was like, and that's what I'm saying, like, even though he was like, you know, a wild boy sometimes, you know, but he was still a sweet guy, like, and that's what I'm saying, like, he would hold on to his religion, like, he really read the Bible, he was always trying to analyze it and talk to you about it, you know?
At the crime scene, police found Rudy's Bible, with pages from it ripped out.
One possible explanation for Rudy's actions that were circulating in the Haitian community was voodoo. That's V-O-D-O-U, not V-O-O-D-O-O, like voodoo dolls and black magic we've seen in pop culture. Voodoo is a religion in Haiti, a blend of several traditional religions from West and Central Africa, along with Catholicism. It's similar to Santeria that's popular throughout the Spanish-speaking Caribbean and Mexico, or Candomblé, which is widely practiced in Brazil. Where Catholicism has saints, voodoo has spirits.
Now, many Haitians would also identify as Catholic, but voodoo beliefs can be found in every part of society, from medicine to agriculture to cosmology. As a famous saying goes, Haiti is 70% Catholic, 30% Protestant, and 100% voodoo.
There's also an aspect of voodoo where someone can be cursed. Dealing with the aftermath of Rudy's death and the circumstances around it, there was a backlash from the Haitian community.
Haiti's different, you know, like somebody who might have a mental illness to us in America, like in Haiti, they might say that person had a voodoo curse on him. If someone acts a certain way, they're gonna be like, oh, somebody put a voodoo on him. That's why he liked that, you know? You know, people making up all kind of outlandish stories.
Even Rudy's girlfriend at the time told the media this wasn't like him, and she suspected it was voodoo.
She does not want people to know him as the, quote, Miami zombie. She suspects, like police, that he was either on something or perhaps she's suggesting that this is voodoo.
She told CBS News Miami, quote, that wasn't him. That was his body, but that wasn't his spirit. Somebody did this to him, end quote.
The Haitian radio talking about, oh, it's voodoo. Somebody put voodoo. The guy's family is a voodoo priest.
The community backlash was severe. Markinson told us there was even difficulty in getting the church his family had been attending for years to get them to do Rudy's funeral.
The church that we grew up in, they want to do the funeral there. And, you know, several different other Haitian churches that we went to, they didn't want to do the funeral there. My mom had to do the funeral at the funeral home instead. And, you know, for a Christian woman, a Haitian Christian woman, you know, that didn't feel good for her at all. You know what I mean? Because she wanted to bury her son in a church.
Now, at the beginning of this story, we did mention that Ronald survived. At first, there seemed to be no connection between Rudy and Ronald.
Originally from New York and a graduate of prestigious Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, Ronald had been homeless since 1976 and spent most of the previous four decades in South Florida and a brief stint in New Orleans in the early 80s. According to a Miami Herald article, the two had apparently met briefly when Rudy was volunteering at a homeless shelter. But it doesn't seem to have been much of an encounter. When Ronald was asked by the police a few months later if he ever remembered meeting Rudy at a homeless shelter, he said he did not. And Markinson told us Rudy had never met Ronald before.
You know, I want us to pause here for a second to point something out that we could have just glossed over. And that's that Rudy had briefly encountered Ronald when he was volunteering at a homeless shelter. Yeah, volunteering at a homeless shelter. It may be a small fact, but it's one of those things that get lost in stories like this, where we can lose sight of the humanity of folks. In his statement, Ronald did say Rudy was friendly at first when he approached him, but then he started saying how they were going to die and then began attacking Ronald.
After the attack, Ronald was taken to Jackson Memorial Hospital in critical condition. 75 to 80% of his face above his beard was missing. His left eye had been gouged out. Over a series of months, he underwent reconstructive surgery, but he was still left totally blind due to the damage to his remaining right eye.
So, what caused Rudy to viciously attack Ronald?
Everyone was waiting for the toxicology report to come back from the autopsy to confirm the theory about bath salts. After a few weeks, the report came back. They did find drugs in Rudy's system, but
the only thing they found was marijuana, not bath salts. Now, I don't know about you, but I've done a lot of pot, and it's never made me want to chew someone's face off.
No, the craziest thing that ever happened to me was I thought there were little gremlins inside my Apple TV screensaver.
Now, they did find a few undigested pills in Rudy's body that were never explained or identified, and some other experts weren't convinced that there still couldn't have been some type of synthetic drug in his system, saying these drugs were so new they were hard to detect.
Maybe they would like to say the drugs go right. Because it's easier when you just say a black man on drugs. It's easier when you say that.
What Markinson is saying is that officials were quick to land on a racist theory rather than actually look for a more probable one. But with Rudy dead and the toxicology reports inconclusive, what led to this? And the topic of different treatment based on race can't be ignored, especially when just a few years later, another eerily similar incident would happen with a white man, except he would live to see another day. Mental illness wasn't something that was talked about when Markinson was young. But looking back now, he sees things differently.
Was he ever diagnosed or treated with anything?
Absolutely not, because no one was thinking about mental illness. In the Haitian house, they're going to say that that kid is, he's bad. He's just bad. Instead of trying to figure out why someone is like that. Because I'm like, I'm 35 now, and I look at like the gamut of his life, like everything that I put it all together, you know, like when I look at everything, I mean, there were definitely like signs of like mental illness, you know, because, you know, he would get upset about things and he would pop off, you know, like my mom called the cops on him, you know what I mean?
I think it's important to contextualize here that for a lot of immigrant communities, mental health is a taboo subject that's not really discussed or even considered as a possibility. I mean, in my own extended family, we have someone with severe mental health issues, and for decades, it's been a subject that's not openly discussed.
Looking back, Markinson sees what happened on May 2012 as a breaking point for Rudy.
Because people who know him, they know him like he's a sweet guy, you know what I mean? Like, he's a very sweet guy, but if you make him angry, sometimes he pops off, you know? So I never really thought nothing of it at that time. But when I look at it in hindsight, I'm like, man, like, there have been signs of this thing going on.
When looking back at the story, another question that comes up is, why didn't the police use alternate means to try to stop Rudy before resorting to shooting him? Like, why not pepper spray or a baton or a taser?
In this country, that we don't value life like that. Because they didn't try to deploy a taser. They didn't try to hit no pepper spray. They didn't try to hit a baton on them. They didn't do nothing. They just shot him. Like, they didn't try to de-escalate it. They didn't, like, I know it was crazy, dog, but that's what you go to training for. That's what you go learn for. Like, you're an officer, bro. You're supposed to be protecting and serve. Like, both lives, you should try to protect both lives if you can, I feel like. And then we could have actually found out what was wrong with him. But you just end him like that, and now his story is over. We don't know anything. We don't even know why. We don't know why he did what he did. We have no idea.
And while Markinson is understandably angered by the death of his brother, he acknowledges and regrets the severity of what Ronald endured at the hands of Rudy.
That's horrible, man, to have to endure that. You know, like, fighting for your life, being overpowered, and then having your whole face demolished, you know? That's horrible.
What he did was a horrible thing. But, like, did he deserve to lose his life? I don't think so. And it made me angry a lot that they just killed him like that. I know he was doing was messed up, but, like, we all know what the truth is. You know what I'm saying? Like, if that was a white man and he did that, I promise you he wouldn't have been dead. Because later on, that same year, there was another individual that did the same, a very similar thing.
That similar thing Markinson is talking about happened in 2016. Police in Central Florida responded to a call where they found a white 19-year-old FSU student named Austin Haruf in the driveway of a house eating another man's face. They tried using a taser, didn't stop him. They tried hitting him in the head, didn't stop him.
A female deputy was about to shoot him when a male deputy said, quote, don't shoot, end quote. They were able to get a police dog to bite Haruf's arm, which was enough to finally force him into handcuffs. And he was taken away. Alive.
What later came to light was he had already murdered Stephen and Michelle Mishkan, a married couple, by stabbing them to death. Stephen Mishkan was already dead when police found Austin eating his face. But Haruf, a young white man, lived, while Rudy, a black man, was killed at the scene.
And he was not killed. You know, that's like, it's just a common thread that happens throughout this country that we live in. Unfortunately, you know what I mean? Like, it's just a different kind of justice that happens.
And that different type of justice is something that Black Americans have had to endure for generations. It's a conversation we've been having a lot lately in the wake of the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and countless others at the hands of police. It has sparked mass protests throughout the country and calls for police reform and defunding.
When they saw him, they saw an animal. They didn't see a human being, not at all. They saw an animal, and they were like, yo, you got to put that animal down.
After Haruf's attack, the same speculation around bath salts and flaca, another synthetic drug, circulated around the media. But again, nothing was found in his system. While in prison, Haruf was analyzed by forensic psychologist Dr. Philip Resnick, who released a 38-page report saying Haruf suffered severe mental illness and believed he was half dog, half man. He's still awaiting trial. As for Rudy, Markinson says that he was deeply loved by many people. But the luxury of being able to be analyzed by psychiatrists and to be alive was something not afforded to Rudy or his family.
You know, when at his funeral, the thing was packed. Everybody had love for him, man. Everybody had love for him. Everybody had love for him.
Markinson also says in the wake of Rudy's murder, he used to dream about his brother.
You know, it's crazy, right? Like in the beginning, when everything was happening, I had three dreams. And like each time, like it was like crazy because like my brother would be there and he'll be alive and he'll like save me out of a situation or something like that. The first two times, that's what happened. And then the third time, I was like, yo, bruh, why you keep doing this to me, bruh? Like you killing me, because I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking you're going to be there, bruh, because it feels so real. And you're not here. You gone, dog. You got to leave me. And this like godlike figure steps up and puts his arm around him and they just walk away. And I never saw him again in my dreams. And I kind of regret it now because, you know, I kind of wish I could just see him again like that. Because it hurt because I ain't going to never see him again like that.
In the 10 years since the attack happened, there has definitely been a change in the conversation and stigma of talking about mental health and well-being.
So 10 years ago, mental health was not even like anywhere near the forefront of our thoughts and ideas as a community, even in the Black community, especially, I would say, like nowadays you have people like Charlamagne the God who talks about seeing his therapist all the time. You understand what I'm saying? So. Like, but I don't feel like 10 years ago, those kinds of things were like at the forefront, like on readily accessible or thought of in the community before. But I think nowadays is definitely something that we think about a lot more. I know I certainly do, because I saw what can happen when no one helps.
There is no one person in Rudy's life that failed him. Markinson sees it as a failure on numerous levels, any of which could have better intervened and possibly changed the outcome of Rudy's life.
We failed them on many levels. Like, it's not just us. Like, as a family, like, we failed them. That's true. We did. I know that. But also the school systems, instead of just giving him referrals, writing them up, you know what I'm saying? Like, we failed them on so many levels. So, like, I'm not just talking to, like, families. I'm talking to teachers. I'm talking to principals, whoever's out there, you know? Like, when you see kids who are bad, ask yourself why, and ask them why, and try to figure it out. You know what I mean? As opposed to just letting people, just suspending people and things like that. Like, you know, we got to dig deeper as a society, like to be able to capture something like that. I feel like we failed Rudy.
Markinson hopes that Rudy's story will make people more aware of the impact of mental illness. As for Ronald, there's a tiny bit of a silver lining to this. His family, including his daughter, hadn't heard from him in over 30 years. They had assumed he was dead.
With the international media attention, he was able to reconnect with his family. He's still been living in a long-term medical facility and took up playing the guitar.
You know, it's crazy because my brother always said that like the world would know his name. And I couldn't have imagined that's the way that it would have been.
After all of this, do you think that there's a positive lesson that can be taken out of all of this situation?
I mean, for me, I took, bruh, let me tell you something. From that situation, it made me who I am today. It made me this happy person, even though I lost my brother. But it made me a very happy person. It made me a very positive person. It made me a person who cherishes life, who understands that life can be gone in an instant. Like, I live life with no fear. The only fear I have is that I don't do what I want to do before I die.
Thank you for listening to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, where each new episode will bring you a true crime story right from the South Florida headlines.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a production of Sonoro and Trojan Horse in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Network. Hosted and produced by Kareem Tapsch, Joey Dowd, and Christian Hatar. Edited by Angelina Mosher Salazar. Fact-checking by Evelyn Uribe and Sara Mota. Engineering by Mane Parra, Daniel Padilla, and Fernando Galaviz. Executive produced by Jasmine Romero and Joshua Weinstein for Sonoro, Kareem Tapsch and Alex Fumero for Trojan Horse, and Giselle Bansis and Conal Byrne for iHeart. Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.